She was talking, quietly, and he knew he'd better listen. I said I was up north with family stuff, but what really happened was a couple of apes found me and took me to San Pedro and put me on this boat. And I never knew what their real plans for me were, because when we got to Maui, I hustled my way off. Some first mate who digs beautiful asses, no doubt. Chief Cook, actually. Then, at Pukalani, I ran into Flip hitchhiking, and he handed me the keys to this place and asked me to house sit. Why are you looking so weird all of a sudden? Around the same time that was happening, V-High Fairfield gave me some acid, and while I was tripping, I saw you, on that same boat, the Golden Fang. I was out in the wind someplace, I don't know, kept trying to get on board, kept close as long as I could. Now it's you that's looking weird. I knew it. I felt something then, and all I could think of was that somehow it might be you. It was so creepy. Must have been me then. No, I meant it felt like being haunted. It's why the first island we got to, I sent you that card. V-High's spirit guide said you weren't on that ship by choice, but that you'd be okay. I wonder if he knew that everybody on board was packing, officers, crew, passengers. She didn't exactly ask about it, but Porfirio, the chief cook, had been happy to explain. Pirates. Excuse me, she said. The cargoes we carry, senorita, are highly desirable, particularly in the third world. Think I could borrow something from the ship's armory to carry with me, just in case?
You are a passenger. We will protect you.
You're sure that's what I am? And not just more desirable cargo?
But this is flirting, yes?
Yeah, yeah, Doc said after a while. So, you said?
I said, ooh, Porfirio. I hope they're not planning to sell me to some horrible Chinese communist gang of perverts who'll do all kinds of horrible Chinese stuff to me.
Doc found some of Fritz's Thai weed and lit up.
Yeah?
After offering her a hit.
And Porfirio said,
allow me to do it all to you first, senorita, with your permission, of course, so that you will at least know what to expect.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, these sailing ships, all the ropes and chains and pulleys and hooks and things.
Okay, that does it. Let's see that cute red ass there.
But, Doc, what did I say?
She knelt on the couch, put her face down on a pillow, and presented herself.
You need a tattoo right here. How about bad, bad girl?
She looked back, her eyes slitted in pink.
Figured you'd go more for a marijuana leaf.
Maybe I better.
No.
What kind of Chi-Com sex slave are you anyhow? You want to just arch your back?
Yeah, beautiful. Like that. They started fucking, and it didn't take very long this time either. A little later she said,
this doesn't mean we're back together.
No, no, of course not. Can I tell you something anyway?
Sure.
I wasn't really pissed off at you, you know, ever, Shasta. Not about us. I never felt like I was any kind of an injured party or nothing. Fact, for a while, when Mickey really looked like another one of these straight-to-freak converts, I was even willing to cut him some slack for that. I trusted you on how sincere he was.
Trouble is,
a little sadly,
so did I.
And if anybody should be revenging themselves on anybody's ass around here...
Oh, said Shasta. Oh, well. Let me give that some thought.
She went in the kitchen and found a box of Fruit Loops, and they put on the TV and sat companionably eating dry cereal and watching the Knicks and the Lakers. Doc would have said, just like in the old days, except this was now... And he'd come to know a lot less than he thought he did then.
Don't you need the sound on?
Nah, it's all those sneakers when they squeak like that.
At halftime, she looked over and said, Something's on your mind.
Coy Harlingen. I ran into him down in Hermosa.
So he really didn't OD like everybody said.
Even better than that, he's clean now.
Glad to hear it. Long may he wave.
But he's caught in something he doesn't want to be in. He's been working as a snitch for the LAPD, and I also saw him on the tube at some Fascism for Freedom rally, pretending to scream at Nixon, working undercover for this outfit called Vigilant California.
Then, Shasta murmured, I guess that one's on my ticket, because it was me who put Coy in touch with Burke Stodger, and it was Burke who set him up with the Vigis.
No excuse, she went on. It was during that very freaky time for everybody up in Hollywood right after Sharon Tate. It had occurred to very few in the hopeful starlet community that regular features and low body weight might not, after all, be counted on to buy you a thing that mattered. The shock of the Cielo Drive murders was bad enough out in civilian life, but the impact on Shasta and her friends was paralyzing. You could be the sweetest girl in the business, smart with your money, careful about dope, aware of how far to trust people in this town, which was not at all. You could be nice to everybody, focus pullers, grips, even writers, people you didn't even have to say hello to, and still be horribly murdered for your trouble. Once-overs you'd found ways to ignore, now had you looking for the particular highlight off some creep's eyes that would send you behind double and triple locks to a room lit only by the TV screen, and whatever was in the fridge to last you till you felt together enough to step outside again.
Which is about when I met Burke Stodger. We were neighbors and used to walk our dogs at around the same time every morning. And I sort of knew who he was, but hadn't seen any of his pictures till one night I couldn't sleep. I went switching around the channels and came across .45 caliber Kiss-Off. Normally, I don't watch that type of movie, but something about this one.
I can relate, cried Doc. That picture made me who I am today. That P.I. that Burke Stodger played, man, I always wanted to be him.
I thought you wanted to be John Garfield.
Well, and that all came true. But guess what? John Garfield also happens to show up uncredited in that same movie. Remember, there's a funeral scene where Burke is sort of discreetly fondling the widow at graveside using an umbrella for cover? Well, if you look closely, just past her left tit, that screen left, a little out of focus, next to a tree, there's John Garfield, in a pinstripe mobster suit and a Homburg hat. He was pretty much blacklisted by that point, and must have figured, a gig's a gig.
Burke ran into that same problem, but said he found another solution.
One that didn't get him hassled into a fatal heart attack. Oops, but there I go, being bitter again.
To the dismay of many in the business, Burke had let himself be gathered into the embrace of the same red-hunting zealots who'd once forced him to split the country. He testified before subcommittees and donated his boat to the counter-subversive cause, and was soon working again in modestly budgeted FBI dramas like I Was a Red Dope Fiend and Squeal, Pinko, Squeal, a run of luck which lasted as long as anti-communist themes kept putting asses in seats. By the time Shasta met Burke, he was pretty much semi-retired, content to go 18 low-stakes holes at the Wilshire Country Club, even 9 if he could find a member who was half-Jewish, or hang out at Musso and Frank's, spinning showbiz yarns with other old-timers. At least the percentage in the industry who didn't cross the street and sometimes the freeway with a nauseous look on their face to avoid him. Burke knew a back way onto the golf course, and he and Shasta had fallen into the habit of making it part of their morning stroll.
For Shasta, this was often the best part of the day, busy with early deliveries, yard and pool work, hosed pavement. Still, cool, smelling like the desert after rain, garden exotics, shadows everywhere to shelter in for a bit before the day's empty sky asserted itself. "I saw you on that Brady Bunch episode," she said one morning.
"I just read for another one, waiting now to hear something about Jan gets a wig."
Bert found an almost unplayed ball in the grass, retrieved it, and slipped it in his pocket. "What kind of a wig?"
"Brunette, I think. She gets tired of being a blonde."
"Tell me about that. Still not the same as changing your politics, I guess." She was afraid she'd been too blunt, but he scratched his head elaborately and pretended to think.
"Well, sure, I have second thoughts. Third and fourth. Up in the middle of the night, all that old guy's stuff. But they've treated me well. I still get out on the boat. Sometimes there's even work."
Despite the ease and promise of the morning, the jaunty straw hat, pastel-striped shirt, and pale linen shorts, some sorrowful veteran actor note had crept into his voice.
"Thanks for not bringing up Vietnam, by the way. We get started on that, you really might begin to think less of me."
"Right now, that's all, like, kind of remote."
"No boyfriends out in the street screaming, 'Death to the pig,' rolling bombs, whatever it is they do?"
She shook her head, smiling. "Forget about political guys. In this business, how many dateable guys do I ever run into?"
"Catch as catch can, and ever thus, kid. Only big difference I see today is the drugs. Pretty much every place I look, so many of these wonderful, promising young folks either ending up in stir or else dead."
By then, of course, she was thinking about Coy. He was not, could never be, the love of her life. But she had enough of an ear for music to respect what he did for a living, if you could call it a living. He was a good friend, free so far of assholery, and even strung out most of the time on smack, had never looked at her in that creepy Mansonoid way. He sure needed a break in his life.
"There is this sax player I've been sort of worried about,"
going on to tell Burke more than she meant to about Coy's history with heroin. "He can't afford to be on a program, but that's what he needs. It's the only thing that'll save him." Burke walked quietly a while in the sun. The dogs came over, and Burke's dog, Addison, looked up at him and raised one eyebrow.
"See that? Too much sitting in front of the TV watching George Sanders movies. No, no. You're too short for that gesture. But now I think of it, there is a recovery program, one they tell me really works. Of course, I have no idea if it's anywhere up your friend's street."
Next time she talked to Coy, she passed along Burke's phone number. And then Coy just disappeared. Nothing unusual. He was always disappearing. One minute he's there, maybe even in the middle of a solo. Next minute, like, whoa, where'd he go? But this time the silence was like something you could almost hear.
"That must have been the first time he went inside that joint up at Ojai," Doc said.
"The first? How many times has he been in?"
"Don't know. But I got the feeling he's a regular up there."
"So maybe he's still using,"
with an unhappy look on her face.
"Maybe not, Shasta. Maybe something else."
"What else could it be?"
"Whatever those people are really into, it ain't helping junkies back on the straight and narrow."
"I should be saying, well, Coy's a grown person, able to take care of himself. Only, Doc, he really can't, and that's why I'm worried. Not just for him, but for his wife and baby, too."
The first time she saw Coy, he was hitchhiking on Sunset with Hope and Amethyst. Shasta was driving the Eldorado, couldn't recall how many times up and down this street she could have used a ride herself, so she gave them a lift. They had some car trouble, Coy said, and were looking for a garage. Hope and Amethyst got in the front, and Coy sat in back. The baby, poor little thing, was so flushed and listless. Shasta recognized the soiled hand of Smack. It occurred to her that the baby's parents might only be in Hollywood to score, but she held off from lecturing. Even by then, she had learned enough being Mickey Wolfman's GF to know she didn't qualify for any grand lady parts. It was luck, dumb luck, that had put them each where they were. And the best way to pay for any luck, however temporary, was just to be helpful when you could.
And you and Mickey were already, like, into it by then?
Doc couldn't help asking.
Nosy fuck, ain't you?
Put it another way, how'd you and Coy's wife get along?
That was the only time I ever saw her. They were staying down in Torrance someplace. Coy was hardly ever home. Did I give him my phone number?
No.
Couple days later, I was on La Brea. Coy was in the line at Pink's, saw the El Dorado, came running into traffic. The rest is history.
Were we an item?
Was I running around on Mickey? What a thing to ask.
When did I...
Listen, in case you haven't figured it out, I was never the sweetest girl in the business. There was no reason for me to waste half a minute on a sick junkie like Coy, who was clearly headed for a bad end. He was not my charity project, and we didn't shoot up together. And anyway, if you stop to think about some of the chicks you've hung out with...
Okay, whatever you meant to do, you ended up saving his life. And then he went on to be a snitch for the LAPD, and an undercover agent for the Vigis and maybe the Golden Fang. The outfit, not the boat. And there's three stiffs so far that may or may not be on his karmic ticket.
Wait, you think Coy?
She got up on an elbow and peered at him red-eyed.
You think I'm in on this, Doc?
Doc stroked his chin and gazed off into space for a while. You know how some people say they have a gut feeling? Well, Shasta Fay, what I have is dick feelings. And my dick feeling says,
so glad I asked. I'm making coffee. You want some?
You bet. But now I was sort of wondering,
uh-oh.
When I said I saw Coy in Hermosa, you didn't seem too surprised.
There was a long silence from the kitchen, except for coffee-making sounds. She came back in and paused in the doorway, one hip out, one knee bent. Beautiful, naked Shasta.
I saw him once in Laurel Canyon, and he made me swear never to mention it to anybody. He said it would be his ass if anybody found out, but he didn't get into details.
Sounds like even then somebody was desperate to keep that cover story from falling apart, which it did anyway, right from the first time Coy ever tried to use it. What the hell did he think was going to happen?
I don't know.
What did you think, back when you got into your PI trip?
Different situation.
Oh, far as I can see, you and Coy, you're peas in a pod.
Thanks.
How's that? Both of you. Cops who never wanted to be cops. Rather be surfing or smoking or fucking or anything but what you're doing. You guys must have thought you'd be chasing criminals. And instead, here you're both working for them.
Ouch, man.
Could that be true?
All this time, Doc assumed he'd been out busting his balls for folks who, if they paid him anything, it'd be half a lid or a small favor down the line, or maybe only just a quick smile, long as it was real.
He began to run through the cash customers he could remember, starting with Crocker Fenway, and going on through studio executives, stock market heroes of the go-go years, remittance men from far away who needed new pussy or dope connections, rich old guys with cute young wives and vice versa. It sure was a piss-poor record, not too different after all, he guessed,
from the interests Coy had been working for. Bummer. Could Shasta be right? Doc must have looked depressed enough. Shasta came over and put her arms around him.
Sorry. Being actressy. Love those zingers. Can't resist them.
You think this is why I'm going crazy trying to figure out a way to help Coy cut loose of these people? Even if I can't do it for myself? Because I can't?
Courage, Camille. You're still a long way from LAPD material.
Nice try. But now it had him wondering.
Later, they went outside, where a light rain was blowing in, mixed with salt spray feathering off the surf. Shasta wandered slowly down to the beach and through the wet sand, her nape in a curve she had learned from times when back-turning came into it, the charm of. Doc followed the prints of her bare feet already collapsing into rain and shadow, as if in a fool's attempt to find his way back into a past that, despite them both, had gone on into the future it did. The surf, only now and then visible, was hammering at his spirit, knocking things loose, some to fall into the dark and be lost forever, some to edge into the fitful light of his attention, whether he wanted to see them or not. Shasta had nailed it. Forget who. What was he working for anymore?
Chapter 18.
As Doc approached downtown L.A., the smog grew thicker, till he couldn't see to the end of the block. Everybody had their headlights on, and he recalled that somewhere behind him, back at the beach, it was still another classic day of California sunshine. Being on the way to visit Adrian Prussia, he'd decided not to smoke much, so he was at a loss to account for the sudden appearance, rising ahead, of a dark, metallic gray promontory about the size of the Rock of Gibraltar. Traffic crept along. Nobody else seemed to see it. He thought about Sortilege's sunken continent, returning, surfacing this way in the lost heart of L.A., and wondered who'd notice it if it did. People in this town saw only what they'd all agreed to see. They believed what was on the tube, or in the morning papers half of them read while they were driving to work on the freeway, and it was all their dream about being wised up, about the truth setting them free. What good would Lemuria do them? Especially when it turned out to be a place they'd been exiled from too long ago to remember. AP Finance was tucked somewhere between South Central and the Vestigial River, hometown of Indians and bindle stiffs and miscellaneous drinkers of Midnight Special, up a wasted set of what looked like empty streets, among pieces of old railroad track brick-walled from view, curving away through the weeds. Out in front and across the street, Doc noted half a dozen or so young men, not loitering or doing substances, but poised and tonic, as if waiting for some standing order to take effect. As if there was this one thing they were there to do, one specialized act, and nothing else mattered, because the rest would be taken care of by God, fate, karma, others. Inside, the woman at the front counter gave Doc the impression of having been badly treated in some divorce settlement. Too much makeup. Hair styled by somebody who was trying to give up smoking. A mini-dress she had no more idea of how to carry than a starlet did a Victorian gown. He wanted to say, "Are you okay?" but asked to see Adrian instead. On Adrian's office wall was a framed picture of a bride and groom, taken long ago somewhere in Europe. On top of the desk was a half-eaten glazed donut and a paper container of coffee, and behind it was Adrian, silent and staring. Heated downtown smog light filtered in from the window behind him,
Life that could not have sprung from any steady or pure scheme of daybreak, more appropriate to ends or conditions settled for, too often after only token negotiation. It would be hard to read anybody, let alone Adrian Prussia, in light like this. Doc tried to anyway. Adrian had short white hair parted at the side to reveal a streak of pink scalp. Ignoring the hair and focusing on his face, Doc saw that it was really more of a young man's face, not too distant from the amusements of youth, not yet, perhaps not ever, fated to grow into the austere competence the hair seemed to be advertising. He wore a sky blue suit of some knit synthetic with a slovenly drape to it, and a Rolex Cellini, which didn't seem to be working. Though that didn't keep him from consulting it now and then to let visitors know how much of his time they were wasting.
So, you're here about Puck. Wait a minute, this is bullshit. I remember you. The kid from Fritz's shop out in Santa Monica, right? I lent you my special edition Kolyostremsky bat once, to collect from that child support deadbeat you chased down the Greyhound and pulled him off of, and then you wouldn't use it.
I tried to explain at the time it had to do with how much I've always admired Yaz.
No place for that shit in this business.
So, what you up to these days? Still skip tracing, or'd you go into the priesthood?
P.I. Doc saw no point in denying.
They gave you a license?
Doc nodded. Adrian laughed.
So who sent you here?
Who are you working for today?
All on spec, Doc said. All my own time.
Wrong answer. How much of your own time you think you got left, kid?
He checked the dead wristwatch again.
I was just about to ask.
Let me buzz my associate in here a minute. In through the door, in a way that suggested indifference about whether it was open, closed, or locked, came Puck Beaverton. This was not going to end well.
Howdy, Puck.
I know you.
I don't think I do.
You look like somebody I ran across once. My mistake.
Your mistake, said Puck, to Adrian Prussia. What do I do with,
angling his head at Doc?
Busy day today, said Adrian, going out the door. I know nothing about any of this.
Alone at last, Doc said.
Helps to have a bad memory sometimes, Puck advised, sitting in Adrian's executive chair and producing a joint a bit longer than the usual, to Doc's eye likely rolled with an easy, wider paper. Puck lit up, had a long hit, and handed it over to Doc, who unthinkingly took it and inhaled, little knowing till too late that Puck, after years of faithful attendance at a ninja school in Boyle Heights, had become a master in the technique known as false inhaling, which allowed him to seem to be smoking the same joint as his intended victim, thus lulling Doc into thinking this number was okay, when in fact it was full of enough PCP to knock over an elephant, which had no doubt been Park Davis's original idea when inventing it.
Acid invites you through the door, as Dinas liked to say. PCP opens the door, shoves you through, slams it behind you, and locks it.
After a while, Doc finds himself walking along beside himself in the street, or maybe a long corridor.
Hi, says Doc.
Wow, Doc replies. You look just like you do in the mirror.
Groovy, because you don't look like anything, man. In fact, you're invisible.
So commencing a classic and, except for the doper's memory factor, memorable bummer. It seemed there were these two Docs, visible Doc, which was approximately his body, and invisible Doc, which was his mind, and from what he could make out, the two were in some kind of ill-tempered struggle, which had been going on for a while. To make matters worse, this was all being accompanied somehow by Mike Kerb's score from The Big Bounce, 1969, arguably the worst music track ever inflicted on a movie. Fortunately for both docs, over the years they had been sent out on enough of these unsought journeys to have picked up a useful kit of paranoid skills. Even these days, though occasionally surprised by some prankster with a straight-looking nose inhaler full of amyl nitrate, or a rosy-cheeked sub-adolescent offering a bite of peyote bud ice cream cone, Doc knew he could count on the humiliation, if nothing else, to pilot him and his adversary Doc safely through any trip, however disagreeable. At least till now. But here, out of, well, not exactly nowhere, but some badlands, at least that unmerciful, came this presence, tall and cloaked, with oversized and wickedly pointed gold canines, and luminous eyes, scanning Doc in a repellently familiar way.
"As you may have already gathered," it whispered, "I am the Golden Fang."
"You mean like J. Edgar Hoover is the FBI?"
"Not exactly. They have named themselves after their worst fear. I am the unthinkable vengeance they turn to when one of them has grown insupportably troublesome, when all other sanctions have failed."
"Okay if I ask you something?"
"About Dr. Blatnoid. Dr. Blatnoid had a fatality for rogue profit-sharing activities, of which his coadjutors have taken an understandably dim view."
"And you actually... what's the word?"
"Bit. Sank these," smiling horribly, "into his neck. Yes."
"Huh. Well, thanks for clearing that one up, Mr. Fang."
"Oh, call me the Golden."
"He's freaking out," somebody said.
"Am not,"
protested Doc.
"Here, this ought to calm him down."
And next thing he knew, a needle was going into his arm, and he had time to begin the reasonable inquiry. "What the..." But not to complete it, until he woke up, mercifully not too many hours later, in a room, handcuffed to an institutional iron bed.
"Fuck?"
Or to put it another way, what was in that joint?
"Feeling better?"
There was Puck, leering at him in a particularly evil way. "No idea you were only a weekend warrior. Could have gone cheap and just used beer." Doc found this hard to follow, but gathered that Puck had deliberately put him on a bad trip, giving somebody a pretext to sedate him and bring him here. Which was where? He thought he heard surf nearby. Maybe was feeling it through beams and joists.
"That you again, Puck? How's the missus?"
"Who told you about that?"
"Uh-oh, what happened?"
"The paramedics gave her a good chance. Better than you got right at the moment."
"What'd you do to her, Puck?"
"Nothing she didn't want.
What fucking business is it of yours?
How quickly they forget. I'm the one that got you two lovebirds together."
"Don't worry about her. I know what to do about her. I even know what to do about you. But there's still something I think you should know. About Glenn."
"Glenn?
Listen, Sportello. I really did warn him just before they nailed him."
"Before they what?"
"Glenn was the target all along, smartass. That outfit he was running guns for didn't trust him any more than the brothers who shitlisted him for being a traitor to his race. And you're telling me this because... you're the only one I know who ever gave a shit about Glenn. Him and me, We were road dogs once. I took shank cuts for him. He did times in the hole for me. Then I turned around and helped set him up anyway. Shitty of me, ain't it? But I owed him the phone call at least, didn't I?
You warned him?
Why didn't he split then?
First straight job he ever had. It's my duty to protect Mickey, the dumb fuck. Fact, you and Glenn are basically the same kind of dumb fuck.
Don't mean to interrupt, but where are we again? And when can I split this place?
When you've been neutralized as a threat.
Doc briefly took in the situation. He was handcuffed, and somebody had taken away his Smith.
I'm not sure, but I'd say zero threat potential.
Adrian had some business in town, but he'll be along soon, and then we can get on with our own business. Like a cigarette?
He waited for Doc to nod yes.
Too bad. I quit smoking. And so should you, asshole.
Puck brought over a folding chair and straddled it backwards. Let me tell you something about Adrian. Up on first-degree murder more times than anybody can remember. Gone free every time. Loan sharking's really only his day job. After the shutters go down, the last numbers get posted. The sweatshop people and the bums off the nickel go where they're going and the street is empty and quiet again. That's when Adrian gets to work.
He's a hitman?
Always was. He just didn't know it till a couple years ago.
Adrian understood from the jump, Puck explained, that what people were buying when they paid interest was time. So anybody that failed to come up with the vigorish, the only fair way to deal with that was to take their own personal time away from them again. A currency much more precious, up to and including the time they had left to live. Severe injury was more than just pain. It was taking away their time. Time they thought they had all to themselves would have to be spent now on stays in hospitals, visits to doctors, physical therapy, everything taking longer because they couldn't move around so good. So it wasn't as if Adrian hadn't been working up to homicide for hire all his career. One day, out on his rounds, Adrian dropped in on a client from the LAPD Vice Squad, who, just bullshitting, happened to mention a certain pornographer and pimp at the fringes of the movie business with interests in nudie bars, modeling agencies, and specialty publishing, whom the department seemed uncommonly eager to be done with. As it turned out, he had also kept lengthy and detailed files on a sex ring based in Sacramento, and was threatening now to blow the whistle unless he got paid a sum he was too small time to understand was out of the question, even though the minor allegations in his story, proven or not, would be enough to bring down the administration of Governor Reagan.
The governor has some great momentum right now. The future of America belongs to him. Somebody can be doing American history a big favor here, Adrian.
Though there were by now any number of souls already on Adrian's ticket, many Louisville Slugger-related, in fact, something in him did a silent and fateful double-take. It may have helped that he had always voted Republican.
Well, simply as a good American, said Adrian, I'd like to volunteer my services, and my only condition is that I shouldn't do any jail time.
How would you feel about being charged but then going free on a plea bargain before it got to trial?
Great, but why even bring me into it? Why not just leave it an unsolved crime?
Federal money. The amount we get depends on our yearly clearance rate. There's a formula. The more cases we clear, the better we make out.
Adrian must have looked uncomfortable, because the cop added,
We can guarantee zero consequences for you, legal or otherwise.
Though he didn't care much for the arrest and arraignment process, and especially not the legal fees, Adrian supposed that was the price he had to pay for the cool, keen-edged thrill that overtook him the closer it got to the actual moment. There was something sexy about it, like a seduction. He arranged for his target to be kidnapped and brought to a vacant warehouse in the City of Commerce, and hired a couple of professionals who specialized in gay S&M.
"Nothing too heavy," Adrian said. "Just work him into a mood. Then you fellas can split."
They looked at Adrian, then the client, then at each other, shrugged, and on the principle of no telling what people will go for, set to work. When they had been paid off and gone, Adrian had his turn.
"You corrupt the innocent," he addressed his victim,
who by now, covered with bruises and welts, had grown unappeasably erect.
"Plus, you keep millions of freaks and losers addicted to their stupid-ass appetites for bleach-blonde pussy and oversized cock. You ruin their family life. You get them to piss so much of their money away they end up coming to me, for shit's sake, just to cover the rent. And then you have the fucking nerve to go after a man like Ronald Reagan, to even put yourself in the same league as him? Big mistake, pal. Fact, there ain't enough left of your life to make a bigger one. So start praying, asshole, for truly I say unto you, your hour is at hand."
Adrian had spent the previous weekend out visiting different suburban shopping plazas, going in home improvement stores, and assembling the kit of tools he now set to work with. The victim's penis, needless to say, came in for extra attention. When the job was over, Adrian took the mutilated corpse and drove it to a freeway under the construction miles away, and dropped it inside the forms for a concrete support column about to be poured. A liberally compensated cement mixer operator, known to friends of Adrian's, then helped encase the remains in what would become a vertical tomb, an invisible statue of someone the authorities wish not to commemorate, but to wipe from the earth. Even today, Adrian could still not drive the freeway system without wondering how many of the columns he saw might have stiffs inside them.
"Brings new meaning," he remarked jovially, "to the expression, pillar of the community."
Besides making sure he was seen with the victim at a West Hollywood bar earlier in the evening, Adrian had set himself up with a shitload of circumstantial evidence. His two assistants from the warehouse were encouraged to come forward as witnesses, and Adrian left blood and fingerprints around the warehouse for the cops to find, and being who they were, to contaminate as much of it as they could. Though the cement mixer operator had unaccountably disappeared, a number of hardware clerks were able to identify Adrian as having purchased items later found at the warehouse, with blood on them, assumed to be the victim's. However, no body meant no case. Adrian signed a statement acceptable to the federal nickel and dimers and walked. Simple as that. It felt like his life had turned a corner. As he was about to discover, there seemed no end to the list of wrongdoers the department would happily see out of the way, and secret Rolodexes filled with the names of private contractors eager for the business, for whom the price, given federal policies of bountiful aid to local law enforcement, was, more often than not, right. In the months, and eventually years, that followed, Adrian found himself specializing in politicals, Black and Chicano activists, anti-war protesters, campus bombers, and assorted other pinko freaks. It was eventually all the same to Adrian. The weapon of choice was usually from his collection of baseball bats, though he could now and then be persuaded to use a firearm, which had mysteriously vanished from some other crime scene remote in time and space. He became a regular around Parker Center,
where they didn't always know his name, but never questioned his presence. It was like finding a life in the military. After years of blind alleys and false starts, Adrian had discovered his calling and reclaimed his identity. Imagine his surprise, however, when one day his silent benefactors, the LAPD, came to him with a request to hit one of their own. What was going on? They knew he was the political guy.
Doing a cop? I don't know. Doesn't have quite that, what do you call it, magic. Unless there's something I'm missing.
On the job, his contact explained, there's a code. There has to be trust. Everything depends on it. It's non-negotiable.
And this detective?
Let's say he's in violation.
A federal snitch, something like that.
Better we don't get into details. As a matter of fact, Adrian recognized the name of this detective, Vincent Indelicato, who had borrowed from APF now and then. Not a problem client. Always came up with payments plus the VIG on time. Adrian also happened to know that Puck Beaverton hated Indelicato from way back and was in fact currently out on bail pending sentence for some penny ante infraction that Indelicato had just busted him on. Something about a pot seed. Adrian had tried to work himself up into the same lethal indignation he'd felt toward pinkos and pornographers, but somehow his heart just wasn't in it. Finally, he summoned Puck.
Look, I've been trying to fix this chicken shit arrest for you, Puck, but they're just being so hard-ass about it.
Don't worry, Mr. P, replied Puck. One of those cases of wrong cop at the wrong time. Vincent Indelicato is the one member of the department that I flat-out fucking hate, and he feels the same about me, so he ain't about to let nothing go.
This have anything to do with Einar?
This fucking cop, every chance he gets, pulling him over, bringing him in for nothing, pure hatred of homos. And Einar, like, he's so innocent, man, he's like a little kid. He can't see how evil it is, how systematic. Son of a bitch Indelicato really needs to be lined up and shot. Too bad I couldn't have got popped for, I don't know, something real. Maybe that would get me some respect inside.
Now that you mention it, Adrian explained about his history as a contract employee, his get-out-of-jail-free card. And what I don't have this time is any true desire. I mean, this Indelicato, he's a customer, he's a shit, but he's nothing to me. I could do him, but so what? Where's the passion, see what I'm saying? Whereas somebody who really, truly hates his ass.
So you mean, I'd get to do it? But they arrest me. And if you do go in on this other little two-bit charge, word gets around on the jailhouse grapevine it was really you that iced the same copper who put you in there, and your yard credibility gets a big speed injection.
So it came about. Adrian solicited the act, Puck performed it. In a perfect justice system, both would have gone down for murder one. But there is no overestimating the lengths to which a force with such deep insecurities as the LAPD will go to act them out.
To top it off, Puck concluded, that fucking seed thing got dealt before it ever came to trial, so I never even had to go inside. Something, huh?
Leaving a question open, Doc said, since we're only chatting here and all. Who was it that hired Adrian?
Who gives a shit? Cop on cop, just a waste of time to ask.
No, it's fascinating, as Mr. Spock would say. Tell me more.
But they both heard the sound of a car pulling into the garage and doors slamming. Soon Adrian, muffled but recognizable, was calling, Pucky? I'm home. Puck was on his feet, and Doc saw from the look on his face, too late as usual, how totally, dangerously insane Sunshine Boy here had always been.
Special treat for you today, Doc. We just got in a shipment of pure number 4. Not a white guy's finger laid on it between the golden triangle and your own throbbing vein. And there's worse ways to be removed forever from a major pain in the ass list. Just let me step out here and get you some. He noticed Doc's glance down toward his ankle and the empty holster rig and smirked. And Doc thought he saw the swastika on Puck's head twinkling too. Yep, got it right here, patting his inside jacket pocket. You'll have it back soon, though I can't say you'll be in much condition to use it. Don't go away now. The door closed behind him, and a deadbolt slammed into place. There is a fairly straightforward way to get out of handcuffs, which Doc had learned as soon as he began having regular run-ins with the LAPD. A metal clip snapped off a ballpoint pen would have worked, but they'd taken his pen away when they took the Smith. Doc always made a point, however, of carrying in different pants pockets, loose, and he hoped unnoticeable, 2 or 3 plastic shims he'd cut long ago from an expired Bullock's charge card that Shasta had left behind. The idea was to slide the plastic strip into one cuff to disengage the locking pawl and also cover the ratchet teeth so the pawl couldn't re-engage. It took a lot of squirming and muscle strain and semi-headstands to get even one of the shims to fall out of his pocket. But finally Doc worked himself out of the cuffs, creaked up off the bed, and had a look around. There wasn't much to see. The door was designed not to open from the inside, and there was nothing to force it with. He pulled the folding chair under the overhead light fixture, stood on it, and unscrewed the bulb. Everything went very dark. By the time he managed to get back down off the chair, he was in the middle of some kind of flashback, possibly from that elephant dope they'd given him. He saw old familiar images, like spirit guides sent to help him out, Dagwood and Mr. Dithers, Bugs and Yosemite Sam, Popeye and Bluto, rotating violently inside intensely saturated green and magenta clouds of dust. And he understood for a second and a half that he belonged to a single and ancient martial tradition in which resisting authority, subduing hired guns, defending your old lady's honor, all amounted to the same thing. He heard movement outside the door, but no conversation, an even chance that Puck was alone. Doc held one of the cuffs and let the other swing free and waited. By the time Puck got the door open far enough to register the darkness inside, before he could say, uh-oh, Doc was on his ass, slamming him in the head back and forth with the loose handcuff, smashing his foot into Puck's knee to bring him down, and then going down after him, giving in to the fury Doc understood would provide the balance he needed to coast through this, grabbing Puck's head and continuing to beat it almost silently against the marble doorsill till everything was too slippery with blood. Puck had dropped a tray with a spoon, needle, and syringe on it, but nothing had broken. Good. Here you go, then. He went through Puck's pockets and recovered his own handgun, a ring of keys, and a pack of smokes and a lighter. The mean-ass shit had even been lying about that, and keeping an ear out for Adrian, carefully cooked up the heroin, drew some into the syringe, and without bothering to clear the air from the spike, drove it into Puck's neck, about where he thought a jugular might be, pushed the plunger the rest of the way down, handcuffed Puck in case he came to, grabbed his huaraches, and slid out into the corridor. It looked empty. He lit up one of Puck's prison menthols, cautiously inhaled in case there was some more PCP in the story, and using the sound of the surf as a guide, moved away from it toward what he hoped would be the street. Puck? It was Adrian, down at the end of the hallway, holding a pistol, and Doc dove out of the way just as he raised and fired it. The round bounced off a gigantic Vietnamese nipple gong hanging nearby. A note, pure and bell-like, filled the house. Doc found himself in a large indoor patio, leading into a room with a conversation pit and a picture window with drapes over it. Some late light off the ocean came through crevices in the drapes. He could see, but only just. He slid into the room and rolled behind a couch, took off one huarache, and threw it back in Adrian's direction. This drew a shot from the patio. The muzzle flash filled the room. The gong was still ringing. Doc felt, more than he heard, Adrian creeping toward him. He waited till he saw a dense patch of moving shadow, sighted it in, and fired, rolling away immediately, and the figure dropped like an acid tab into the mouth of time. Then there was no more shooting. Doc waited 5 minutes, or maybe 10, until he heard crying somewhere in the long, invisible room. "That you, Adrian?"
"I'm fucking lunch meat," sobbed Adrian. "Oh, shit."
"Did I get you?" said Doc.
"You got me."
"Fatal, I hope."
"Feels like it."
"How can I know for sure?"
"Maybe it'll be on the news at 11, asshole."
"Stay there. Try not to croak. I'll call this in." He went looking for a phone. Nobody seemed to be shooting at him. He was calling the ambulance when he heard sounds of activity from directly beneath the floor in what he guessed to be the garage. He found some stairs and cautiously crept down them to have a look. Busy offloading a 20-kilo parcel from the trunk of a Lincoln Continental was Bigfoot Bjornsson, who regarded him without surprise.
"Did you take care of them okay? Anything I can..."
"You fucking set me up, Bigfoot. What's the matter? You don't have the balls to do this yourself?"
"Sorry about that. I'm in enough shit personally with the captain, and I've seen you on the range."
"And that there? Is that what I think it is?" A brief beat, as if a congested mass of snow, high on a mountainside, were waiting permission to avalanche. Bigfoot shrugged.
"Well, it's only one. There's more. Enough left for evidence."
"Uh-huh. And the one you're taking here has a street value higher than you think only cops know how to count. Bigfoot. Bigfoot. I saw the movie, man. And as I recall, that character comes to a bad end."
"I have obligations."
The garage door was open. Bigfoot brought the package over to a 65 Impala parked on the apron, popped the trunk, and put it in. "This is the golden fang you're about to rip off here, man. The fully fucking weird outfit, if you recall, that iced one of their own board members up in Bel Air the other night."
"That's according to your own delusional system, of course. Our current thinking in the division is focused more on an irate husband's list of, admittedly, considerable length. Can I offer you a lift?"
"Nah. You know what? Fuck this. In fact, fuck you. I'm gonna walk." He turned and started off.
"Ooh."
Doc kept going. The sun was just down, a sinister glow fading out above the edge of the world. As he walked, he began to notice something increasingly familiar about this stretch of stucco bungalows and beach shacks, and after a while, remembered that it was Gummo Mark's Way, where, according to the files Penny had let him see, Adrian had a house, and Bigfoot's partner had been shot down. Major arterial to the impulsive and already forsaken, and uphill, no matter what anybody's geometry teacher had told them, in both directions. Who knew how many times Bigfoot had been out here since the death of his partner, in how helpless a state of passion? Doc resisted the impulse to look back.
Let Bigfoot go about his business. It couldn't be more than a couple of miles to a bus stop, and Doc needed the exercise. He could hear wind up in the palm trees and the regular beat of the surf. Now and then a car came zooming by on yet another thankless chore, sometimes with